Welcome back to Shake Up Your Workup, your go-to veterinary podcast for daily diagnostics. Each episode, we dive into innovative diagnostics and real-world clinical practice to help practitioners navigate both typical and not-so-typical workups. Today's episode is Working Up Chronic GI Patients, More Than Gut Instinct. Internal medicine specialist Dr. Yvonne McGrady joins our host Dr. Sylvia Conway to break down a clear step-by-step approach to evaluating chronic GI disease in dogs and cats. They will dig into the essentials: meaningful history taking, smart dietary trials, and understanding when to lean on microbiome insights, fecal transplants, or advanced diagnostics. Really getting to a workup that gets you closer to the true underlying cause. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Shake Up Your Workup. I'm your host, Dr. Sylvia Conway, and today's episode is Working Up Chronic GI Patients, More Than Gut Instinct. Our special guest today is Dr. Yvonne McGrady, and Yvonne is an internal medicine consultant with the IDEXX UK-based team.
Thanks very much, Sylvia. Lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Yvonne, normally when we get a guest on the show, we ask them a question to kind of ascertain a little bit more about them and who they are as a person. You and I have known each other for quite some
too
time.
Long.
So I do, too long. Thanks for that. So I do know a little bit about you. And I think it would be really nice. In my opinion, Yvonne is one of the biggest veterinary rock stars in the world. And I think that our listeners would be really interested to hear what you were doing 2 days ago, Yvonne. So if you can tell us what you were doing out in clinical practice 2 days ago.
I think you might need to get out more, Sylvia, if that's how you're introducing me. But thank you for that. I appreciate it. I've just been very lucky in my career. And for the listeners, I moved to France a short time ago, and I became friends with some vets in the practice where I worked that dealt with zoo animals and exotics. And I showed some interest, and now I kind of work alongside them. So it's a company called Fonvet. And so on a intermittent but regular enough basis, I work with them on mainly big cats. So just the other day, I was helping investigate some hypertension in a tiger. So yeah, it's pretty cool, I have to say so myself, and I feel very lucky to be involved with that.
I don't think the rock star was an exaggeration of one when you're saying, you know, just the other day I was, you know, working on hypertension in a tiger. I mean, I don't think there's too many of us that can say that about our day to day. So super cool that you get to do those things. But obviously your specialty is in small animal medicine, despite the fact you get to work with these big guys. So today we're going to focus on the smaller guys and about chronic GI signs. So we'll start at the very, very beginning. What are the most prominent signs of GI disease that we see in patients that present to us? So beyond the usual kind of vomiting and diarrhea, what other things might be pointing towards GI signs?
Often a disturbance of appetite, so either an anorexia or dysorexia, or an appetite that has changed, so they're more selective, and obviously weight loss. But also they can sometimes present with signs of pain or just not being quite right, that ain't doing right kind of patient that we like to talk about. So it can be very variable. And although diarrhea and vomiting are things that are very obvious to the client, sometimes the signs can be a little bit more subtle.
And because of these more subtle signs, are there some questions that we should really always remember to ask our clients when they're coming in with these patients?
Yeah, so I still currently work in practice with interns, and I think it's really important when they're doing any form of consultation before we discuss it, that we have a plan in advance of how we're going to approach the case. And certainly with any form of GI disease or suspicion of GI disease, it's actually imperative, in my opinion, that they ask what the dietary history is. And I think that often gets overlooked. So many cases of GI disease are linked to a dietary intolerance or allergy potentially, and it's absolutely critical we know what that animal is being fed and what it's been exposed to, so that we can ascertain whether they've already had a dietary trial, whether that's been ruled out, or whether there's something in that dietary history that might be provoking the changes we've been seeing more recently. Also, part of the consultation, the questioning, is finding out by asking specific questions of the owner whether the animal, if it does have diarrhea, whether that diarrhea is more likely to be associated with large intestinal or with the small intestine? Is there gut gurgling? Is there evidence of nausea, which can be difficult to put your finger on in animals, but maybe licking their lips or salivating a little bit? So sometimes the subtle things that the owners won't have really considered. But if we ask specific questions, they'll often go, oh yeah, he does do that. You're right.
Okay, awesome. When it comes to chronic disease, which is what this podcast is around, how do we define chronic vomiting or chronic diarrhea? When does it become chronic and not just, oh, he's ate something, he's got a bit of an upset stomach?
Well, it depends where what you read, but most people would agree that once we've passed a period of about 3 weeks and an animal's had vomiting for that period of time despite supportive care, that would be considered chronic. Some people would say it's after a week. So it does depend on who you read and what you believe. But I usually go by about 3 weeks, and that's with supportive care. And despite that, we've still got vomiting. I would consider that chronic.
And the same with diarrhea, would you consider 3 weeks of diarrhea chronic?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Same rules apply, in my opinion, yes.
And would that be the same for cats and dogs, or does that vary slightly?
No, I think it's pretty much the same in cats and dogs. Really, any length of time with support. Well, I'm still talking about with supportive care. So, you know, if they've done nothing, then they haven't really done anything to change it. But if they've introduced supportive care, and despite that, we still get vomiting or diarrhea, it becomes chronic, in my opinion.
And what about kind of more weird signs? So we get these animals that, you know, they're eating grass stuff or eating other weird stuff or you know, those vague signs that you mentioned, things like anorexia and nausea. When do we start to worry that this is becoming chronic? Because these heart signs are a little bit more difficult to pick up on.
If it's anorexia, then clearly an animal shouldn't be allowed to go without eating for even a relatively short period of time, particularly in cats, because that can provoke lipidosis. So if we've got total anorexia for more than a couple of days, then regardless of what other signs are present, that should be investigated. But if it's just what you might describe as a capricious appetite or an intermittent appetite, that can go on for much longer. But if an animal is eating less or being more selective about what they're eating, we need to look at the bigger picture as well to see what's changed. Has there been a change in what they've been offered? Could it actually be not so much a GI problem, but could it be a behavioral problem? Do they just not like the diet? Has something happened in the house? Do they associate the diet with something unpleasant? For example, I don't know, want to go into horrible details, but if you've ever had food poisoning, probably for the good while, you're going to associate the meal that you ate that gave you food poisoning with something you do not want to eat again.
So I still can't eat spaghetti hoops. And that was, I think I was eight years old at the time. Well, but I still can't eat spaghetti hoops.
I rest my case. So, you know, in that occasion, if you're trying to feed the animal something that they're associating with feeling ill, that's probably not going to work. So we need to have some kind of psychological input here as well, and try and think about the patient and say, well, could they have gone off this food because they didn't had an acute bout of vomiting or diarrhea, but now they've got an aversion to that diet and we need to switch to something else to stop them associating with that with feeling unwell.
Okay, so I've had a patient that I've now determined has a chronic issue because it's been 3 weeks with some supportive treatment and the animal hasn't improved. We still have a problem. So I'm either vomiting or diarrhea, but it's clearly a chronic GI problem. What do I do? What's my first steps in terms of further diagnostics for this patient?
So what we need to know is a very good clinical history. So regardless whether you're a GP vet or a specialist vet or anything in between, we really need a very good clinical history. Even if your time is short, try and get as much out of the client as possible. And that's also going to include dietary history. So knowing what the animal has been exposed to in its life. Okay, we don't need to know about every treat it's had since day one, but having a rough idea of whether it's fed food scraps or whether it's specifically on just biscuits from a supermarket or a veterinary food company, knowing what they've been exposed to and what could be a dietary challenge for them is really, really important. Also knowing things like worming history, whether there's any other animals in the same household affected, because that's going to increase your risk of it being something infectious. All these things are really, really important. So history comes first. Once again, very, very simple, good clinical examination. have to say that often with GI disease, we don't get that much in clinical examination, maybe slightly tender abdominal palpation, but not much more. But that doesn't mean we can rule it out. And if there's any history of large intestinal disease, so we're talking about signs of colitis with blood or mucus in the stools or urgency, then that clinical exam should include a rectal examination. That's really, really important too. Then beyond that, we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of which tests to do. And that's going to be structured by what the client has discussed with you in the history. But really, we shouldn't be going for any big invasive tests until the basics have been done. And for an animal with a standard, if such a thing exists, GI problem, we definitely want to consider fecal analysis if there's diarrhea involved. So I'm going to look for fecal parasites, probably salmonella and campylobacter, giardia for sure. And if it's a cat, I want to know if there's trichomonas. And I want to have had a dietary trial, assuming they've had some kind of symptomatic therapy. We're talking about chronic disease now, so, and some kind of dietary trial. Unless they're really, really sick, I'm not going to launch into doing more than that until I have that information. That's my basics. If they're really sick at the time of presentation, that's going to change. We can't maybe wait 2 or 3 weeks to do a dietary trial or to get results back of fecal analysis. But if they arrive in the consultation, they're relatively stable and it's a chronic disease, those are the things that I want to do first.
And if I'm not sure, 100% sure that this is a primary GI problem, I'm assuming that these patients probably are going to have more varied signs or present more sick. What would you recommend then? So if the patients come and I'm not sure if it's a primary GI thing or if it's secondary to a more systemic illness.
Yeah, then your basic bloods are going to be the first port of call. Well, not first as such, still history and clinical examination going to be very important. But we're probably going to advance that little bit further and go for bloods. And that those bloods are going to include things like electrolytes, albumin. I obviously want renal parameters and hepatic parameters. Almost certainly, if there's any vomiting or abdominal pain involved, I'm wanting either DGGR lipase or SPECT-PL to ascertain whether there's any evidence that might support pancreatitis, and probably vitamin B12 and folate, plus or minus TLI. TLI will be based on whether there's any evidence that might support an exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, so maybe an increased appetite despite weight loss. Gone are the days when dogs with EPI used to have these, you know, really sticky, horrible white stools. I don't know what's changed over time. Maybe we're picking up earlier. So if it's weight loss and a good appetite, I'm still going to include TLI. And don't forget the good old pretender Addison's. So we're talking about dogs here. Still never seen an Addison's in cat. I'm very sad. Maybe one day. But ultimately, if we have a dog with waxing, waning signs, GI signs, particularly if it's a young adult, I'm going to want to know that I'm not dealing with a unitremic eukalemic Addison's, otherwise known as atypical Addison's. I'm going to want at the very least a basal cortisol or an ACTH stim.
Is there any difference in your approach, Yvonne, between a younger patient versus an older patient in terms of the initial diagnostics that you choose?
Yeah, so in young animals, there's probably a greater chance of the symptoms, particularly with diarrhea, being related to infectious causes. So I'm probably going to focus more on infectious causes in very young animals. With the older animals, there's probably an increased risk of neoplasia. So that's going to be the back of my mind. But chronic enteropathies can affect animals of all ages. And then somewhere in the middle, the young adults, if we're considering dogs, Addison's is on my list as well. But Addison's has been diagnosed in anything from a puppy up until a very old dog. So we can't eliminate it from our differential list just based on age alone.
And same question really for, you already mentioned some of the cat specific and dog specific tests, but would your clinical approach or your diagnostic approach change at all between cats and dogs?
Not as much. No, not really. Because the same approach is required. Obviously, there are certain diseases that cats will have that dogs don't, and vice versa. The two I'm thinking of are mainly trichomonas, which is something we get in cats and not something we recognize too often in dogs, and Addison's in dogs, which we don't recognize too often in cats. So that's probably the main difference, but otherwise the approach I would feel is much the same.
So there's a lot of buzz at the moment, Yvonne, around the microbiome and how this is impacting GI health, but also just general health. What are your thoughts on the microbiome and its importance?
Well, the microbiome is so interesting, and we really just, I think, are at the beginning of our research in this, and not just the microbiome in the GI tract, but we're also discovering there's microbiomes in different parts of the body, and it is so important. And I think we as vets have been too happy in the past to prescribe antibiotics, and perhaps without as much thought as we would like. And that's particularly true for chronic diarrhea. There's really no specific indication for antibiotics in chronic diarrhea. I would use antibiotics in a parvovirus, but that's an acute diarrhea. Really in chronic diarrhea, they're not indicated. And we know they can have such a deleterious effect on the microbiome. There's all these millions of bacteria in the gut that are there to do a job, and all we do is wipe them out with antibiotic therapy. So we need to limit our use of antibiotics to prevent disease later on in life. We need to avoid the use of antibiotics for diarrheic patients because they're generally not indicated. And we need to be thinking about modifying the microbiome if we feel there's an issue. So in just in the last year or so, we've just had this new test come on the market for the dysbiosis index. I wouldn't say it's something I would use in every patient, but it's very, very useful in that we can analyze a sample of stool, and we can ascertain whether the correct parameters are there to indicate whether there's a dysbiosis or not. Normal in dogs and cats, in case anyone's interested, but you get this in your report, is usually less than zero. So once it becomes positive, we know we've got a dysbiosis, and that can then prove what we believe is the underlying cause. So dysbiosis is responsible for the diarrhea or the GI signs, but it can also help us with therapy. So there's a lot of buzz as well around fecal or microbiota transplantation just now, and a lot of studies proving that it can be a very useful adjunctive therapy. I wouldn't say it's something I would rush into straight away. It's definitely an adjunctive therapy. It doesn't replace all the normal parts of the therapy, the dietary change, maybe probiotics and the like, but it's certainly an adjunctive form of therapy for animals where they're not responding to treatment. So we now no longer like calling things inflammatory bowel disease. It's a chronic enteropathy. And we know that chronic enteropathies can be split into different categories. So we can have a food responsive enteropathy, and that's why we do our food trial, because they're very, very common. We can have a probiotic responsive enteropathy. That's kind of considered to be a subcategory now, really. They used to have antibiotic responsive enteropathy on the list, but that's been kind of sidelined to try and discourage people from using antibiotics, and also because it's just generally not indicated. And finally, immunosuppressive responsive enteropathy. So we go through those stages of trying diet, maybe trying probiotics, trying immunosuppressant therapy. And at that stage, if I'm finding I've not got good control over the diarrhea, at that stage, I'll think about modifying the microbiome with a fecal transplant. I get more experience in doing that in cats than I do in dogs, mainly because I see a lot of cats in my practice. It's not, you know, a panacea. It's not something that's always going to be effective. And I think when people do the fecal transplants, the important thing they need to make sure is, do they have the right recipient? Do they have the right donor? So the recipient, they need to have made sure they're not dealing with an animal that's actually got an infectious disease first. They need to have done their dietary trial. And then as far as the donor's concerned, they need to have been screened for all the infectious diseases to make sure they can't transmit something to the recipient. We need to make sure they've got a healthy microbiome. So really testing them with the dysbiosis index first to make sure they are a good donor, because if we use a donor that doesn't have a good microbiome, it's not going to do any good to the recipient. That'll be a waste of time. And also making sure that donor hasn't had antibiotics in probably about the last 6 months, isn't on any treatment, hasn't had any GI signs. So there's a best chance that their microbiome is healthy and that can be transplanted into the donor patient. If we do that, we've got greater chance of success. And also, vets need to remember that often once isn't enough. So you do one transplant, maybe there's a temporary improvement. That doesn't mean it's totally failed. Sometimes you have to do it two, perhaps even three times in order to see a good response.
And in terms of our listeners, if they wanted to have a go at this, are there resources that we can refer them to, Yvonne? Where can they, what should they do if they think, you know what, I'm really interested in this. I wouldn't mind trying a bit of this fecal transplant, but the practicalities around that, is there somewhere we can point our listeners to for tips on that?
Thanks, IDEX. I think there was a very recent webinar on this on the IDEX Learning Center, so that'd be a good place to go. Also, lots of resources online. If they just look for fecal transplantation in animals, there's a lot of free resources. But it's not a very technical procedure. It's literally just a case of getting feces from a healthy donor, and all you need is a blender, probably one you're not going to use for anything else, I would recommend. And, you know, some saline and a supple urinary catheter and a syringe. It really is that simple, because all you're doing, without trying to make it sound too ridiculous, is you're blending the donor feces in a mixer with the saline to consistency that you can inject through a urinary catheter. That urinary catheter is passed into the recipient patient. And you try and make sure that that patient doesn't defecate for a while afterwards. So there's some preparation of the recipient. They need to maybe have had an enema or had the chance to empty their bowels beforehand. Some animals might need sedated in order to perform it, but not all. But, it, you know, the protocols vary a little bit, but the bottom line is, if you pardon the pun, sorry. That's terrible. The bottom line is that all we're doing is putting feces from one patient into another and trying to get it to stay there long enough so that there'll be some change to the microbiome. So it's definitely something that can be done in general practice, but it should not replace all the initial steps of a good workup and good therapeutic trial for GI disease.
Yeah, no, I think it's a super cool thing. And having watched that webinar is really interesting. And those,
I don't
like
think
you
it's
said,
cool
the...
at all. I hate the days when I've got to do a fecal transplant.
Well, I mean,
I know I'm going to be there with my blender. It's not
cool
fun
to watch it on a webinar, but maybe the practicalities.
Maybe.
Do you have sort of face protection as well, Yvonne? That was some essential equipment you forgot to mention.
Yes, I think a mask is usually a priority for the smell, but you know, when my colleagues in the hospital are like, oh, what's that smell? Is Yvonne doing a fecal transplant again?
Is that the blender again? God help us.
It's not my favourite treatment, but it can be a useful treatment in animals that aren't responding to other things.
Okay, that's great. We'll put the link to that course in the description for this podcast so you guys can access that at home. So talking a lot there about the microbiome and how to kind of apply that, what about something we haven't touched on yet, biopsies? When do we go down the route of doing GI biopsies?
Well, we medicine specialists are perhaps going to put ourselves out of business somewhat, because we've kind of gone full circle. It used to be we biopsied everything and we wanted to know exactly what's going on. I guess I can only speak for myself, but I do that less and less these days, because let's face it, how many times does it just come back lymphocytic plasmacytic enteritis? I will biopsy if I'm worried that I'm missing something unusual. So for example, well, let's start with cats. If a cat has chronic diarrhea, there's always the worry that it could be a GI lymphoma. And it can be a very difficult diagnosis to make unless you have full thickness biopsy. So in that case, really your endoscopic biopsies probably aren't going to be too useful. I want to do full thickness biopsies to get a definitive diagnosis. But I'll use other modalities first to increase my suspicion. I'll be doing ultrasound. Are there any changes in ultrasound which increase my suspicion of lymphoma rather than just being a chronic enteropathy? And in that case, I might decide to biopsy. Clearly, if there's a mass, I'll probably choose to biopsy. In dogs, the same rules apply. Unless they've got something specific on ultrasound that really worries me, I don't automatically go for biopsy anymore. But I might biopsy if there's a mass or if there's something unusual or if the history or clinical findings don't fit and I'm just worried there's something a little bit unusual. Also for things like large intestinal disease, if it's a specific breed, where I'm worried there might be a granulomatous colitis or something like that, biopsies are going to be very important, because then we can do other tests on those like fish or culture to look for underlying bacteria. So there are certain situations where, yes, I would biopsy, but I wouldn't say it's a standard of care in my workup of GI patients anymore. I'm looking for changes there that might put me off it being a bog standard, if such a thing exists, chronic enteropathy.
And I know you work, Yvonne, in a referral clinic, and you see a lot of these probably chronic GI cases. What are the things that you see most commonly that you think, oh, they should have just done this before they referred it to me, or, oh, again, they haven't done this? What is there something that comes up a lot?
Okay, well, on my tombstone, I would like to have written, please do a dietary trial. Because I think that is one step that's missed, and it's such a simple thing to do, and it can make such a huge change. So, you know, if they're considering referral, I wouldn't refer until you've done at least one dietary trial. And that should be either with what I prefer now to be a hydrolyzed hypoallergenic diet or a novel protein diet. And if they don't respond to one, it doesn't mean they won't respond to another. So if the animal's not unwell, if it's not critical that things are done rapidly, I would really, really like to see more cases having dietary trials before referrals considered, because that really is such an important first step.
Yvonne, you're going to love my next question, because I'm gonna throw out another lovely pun for you here. So I've absolutely loved hearing everything about chronic GI disease, and I am gutted that we're going to have to wrap up now. So if you could give us your top three tips or takeaways when it comes to shaking up your workup for patients with chronic GI disease.
Okay, top three: good history, good clinical exam, start with a dietary trial unless the animal's quite unwell. I think for me, that would be it in a nutshell. There's a lot more to dietary. There's a lot more to GI disease, but that's where I'd like to see everyone starting.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Lovely to be here. Thanks very much.
Thanks for tuning in. This episode was hosted by Dr. Sylvia Conway and produced by me, Isolde Schroeder, with consulting producers Hannah Fries and Kate Benjamin. Shake Up Your Workup aims to share helpful information and guidance. However, listeners are cautioned that diagnostic recommendations or discussions shared during this episode may not be applicable to every situation, and regulations regarding diagnostics and treatment may vary by region. Listeners should also consult with their own veterinarian or qualified animal health professional before making any decisions regarding diagnostics, treatments, or patient care. And to learn more about the topics discussed today, please check out the episode description for links to resources and free online courses from the IDEXX Learning Center. Never miss an episode of Shake Up Your Workup podcast by following us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. You can leave us comments, you can send us questions or feedback by emailing us at shakeupyourworkup@idexx.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time when we shake up our workup with a smarter approach to using and interpreting fine needle aspirates.